I want to kick off discussion by posing a question to actually both of you. The beginning of my presentation, and this is only for the sake of debate, I suggested that the likely outcome in the short term is stability because we have a government with a comfortable majority, so not necessarily anticipating problems in the presidential elections process. But there are some people who look at this and say, well, you know, Turkey is electing a new president sometime in September, as the calendar goes, mid-September. At the same time, having a referendum the next month. So, you know, could this very tight schedule possibly be thrown off in your view that Turkey does not necessarily elect its next president in parliament, but elect it through popular vote? And what kind of a country would that look like at that stage?
Alan?
I'd rather not prognosticate. I mean, it's not appropriate for me as a U.S. official to try to figure out where Turkish politics will go from here, other than to say what I said at the end of my presentation, which is that we hope that this process will be a smooth one. We took note of what Prime Minister Erdogan said last week about seeking a consensus candidate. Consensus seems to be what's most necessary now after this election. Prime Minister made that a central theme, in fact. I mean, the coming together, the unity of the Turkish nation and country was a major theme of his speech yesterday. I should add one other point, too, I didn't mention in my presentation. I mean, these results are preliminary. So as an official, we are not at a point where we're offering formal congratulations yet, at least not while I'm sitting here, to the Prime Minister and the AK Party, because the results haven't been certified, and that hopefully will happen quite soon. It is not, by the way, as you know, many of you, constitutionally required for President Cezer to turn to Prime Minister Erdogan to form a new government, but it's almost certain he will. I mean, that's the tradition, but there's no constitutional guarantee. So I'm trying to be a little bit careful today over what we say and how far we go, because if we so respect Turkey's democracy and its democratic system, then we have to let that democratic system play itself out. And the same goes with the presidential election. It's going to play itself out. If the choice is a consensus candidate, then we know exactly what's going to happen, right? Presumably, if there's a consensus after the government is formed in mid-August, then the parliament will take to the task of selecting the president, and that should all be done if it's a consensus candidate within a relatively short time, well before the October holding of the referendum on the direct popular election of Turkey's next president in 2014, if everything goes according to that smooth glide path.
Alan?
Sure. Well, I largely agree with Matt. I thought Erdogan's acceptance speech last night suggested that he is not looking for confrontation. He's looking for something, at least if not consensus, something that will be acceptable to the traditional establishment. And I expect him to go that way. Now, that said, I think he made clear during the campaign, and I'd be willing to hear if someone interpreted it otherwise, that he wants the president certainly to come from within parliament. And in effect, from his own party. Now, that means presumably someone who's on the more secular side of his party. The defense minister, Vejdi Gönül, was, of course, talked about so much on the last go-round. Obviously, one of the key attributes of someone who will be seen as an acceptable candidate for the establishment is that is an unhead-scarved wife. In fact, everyone knows that. And I do expect him to go that route. Now, as for the issue, he needs to get a quorum, obviously, in order not for Parliament not to break up. He needs two-thirds. He falls a little short of that, falls about 27 votes short of that. I think with his huge majority and in the stunning aftermath of this, I don't see any way, really, that he will be denied that. That quorum, as he was the last time around. I think the Turkish electorate would only punish a party that broke up parliament once again, and I don't think either MHP or CHP want to put themselves in that position. If, however, he nominates Gould, that will certainly be an interesting test case.
Thanks, Alan. After having used my prerogative as the chair and asking the first question, now, as a speaker, I have a comment also before I open the floor for questions. I was listening to Matt's discussion on the many avenues of cooperation from energy to others and Alan's comments on this thriving relationship. It brought back to my comments, and I think this is a chance for me to elaborate, that there seems to be a cognitive dissonance in Turkey in terms of the U.S. relationship with the U.S., especially among the common Turks, that there's so much happening, yet few people know so little about all the good things happening, and they don't necessarily take ownership of all the good things that are happening, and that's what I mean by the dissonance, that unless you are, you know, with the MFA or you are a foreign policy correspondent in Ankara, you know, you think there's really nothing to the U.S.-Turkish relationship, which is not the case, and I think this is where it would really help for the government in its new term to take a new attitude to the relationship and basically, you know, be the way that it acts in the relationship and speak out the way that it acts in support of this very important relationship. I have a number of questions waiting. I have my good friend, Ambassador Mark Paris, back there. If you can just get up to the mic.
Senator, I'm glad you brought us back because that's exactly where I want to go. Actually, listening to the various panelists, I sensed that there was quite a range of viewpoint in terms of assessing the current state of U.S.-Turkish relations, both in terms of quantity and in quality. And the one firm point of reference, I think, that we have out there is this 9% figure in terms of the U.S. current popularity rating, which is a pretty stark figure. And you seem to suggest and have just suggested again that that is in large measure because the ruling party and its leadership have not properly marketed the relationship, and that it's important for them next time to get this right. I'd like to ask the other two panelists if they agree that this 9% is a function primarily of the current government, the first Erdogan government's failure adequately to promote the relationship, or whether there are other factors such as Iraq, which Alan mentioned prominently. And if they had tried to talk it into a better place, would it have been sufficient to overcome those systemic problems?
No, Iraq is absolutely no, of course, it's the Iraq, the whole question of Iraq is, I think, what is overshadowing the relationship. I mean, obviously it is, and I don't think Soner was discounting that by any means. I mean, everybody has to agree, as I was saying, that we have not done what we pledged to do in delivering on PKK. And even more deeply than that, I think we need to be sensitive to the perception in Turkey that, A, what's happened in Iraq has created concern and instability along Turkey's southern border, although business is not so bad for a lot of Turkish entrepreneurs in northern Iraq right now, frankly. They're doing quite well. But clearly we've created or emerging has been in Iraq that is the reason for significant concern in Turkey about general instability, about the situation in Kirkuk, as well as the whole cavalcade of Kurdish issues. So on the south, there's a sense of instability. In the north, there had been concern about the Black Sea and deep misinterpretations of what the heck we were supposedly up to with the rest of our NATO allies and trying to ensure there could be a NATO maritime presence in the Black Sea beyond NATO members among the littoral states. And many serious strategic thinkers in Turkey misperceive some sort of U.S. attempt to undermine the fundamental legal framework of Montreux and then Lausanne, which seemed to echo to the south in Iraq and conjured up those painful memories of 1920. I know we've corrected our policy in the Black Sea. We've been very clear with our friends in the strategic community of Turkey that, of course, there's no whatsoever, absolutely no desire or intention to undermine the legal framework that is the foundation of the Turkish Republic. But what I'm saying is Iraq fed into what we're doing in the Black Sea, undermined confidence in our relationship among some in Turkey. And I won't even go into the broad political perceptions beyond that and the mood about the United States that I don't even want to speculate any further. What I will say, where I agree with Soner, is that from time to time, the political elite in Turkey, as in any country, or as in many countries, unfortunately, has decided to make our relations, political issue, in a negative sense. And we went through a terrible period after March 1st or July 4th, 2003. By the way, I'd say that July 4th incident has been horribly misportrayed in the Turkish press and in general. There's a deep misunderstanding of what actually happened and why it happened. And yeah, there's plenty of blame to go around on both sides, but the way it's been portrayed in film is absolutely disgusting and wrong and not at all reflective of reality. But that contributed to the mood. And we went through a rough period until Prime Minister Erdogan came here in June of 2005, and the relationship seemed really to get back on track in terms of the Turkish government then saying, you know, U.S.-Turkish relations matter. The United States is our friend. And we heard very laudatory statements from senior Turkish leaders, including Foreign Minister Gül, about PKK in Europe, where I think we should be proud of what we've done together with Turkey and our other European allies in working to undermine PKK support mechanisms. It's not enough. That's the beginning in terms of combating the PKK. But we did a lot, and the Turkish government did recognize it. Now we've gone through an election campaign, and frankly, sure, it would be great to hear more and unequivocal statements of support for U.S.-Turkish relations. But I didn't interpret what Soner was saying, and I certainly wouldn't agree that the 9% mark, truly embarrassingly dismal rating for the United States and Turkey, is simply a result of the Turkish government's rhetoric.
Yes. I certainly would see Iraq, as I indicated in my talk, as and Iraq-related issues as the primary source of problems in our bilateral relationship, which, by the way, is somewhat gratifying because if we ever do get past this very difficult problem, I think there is real hope for restoring the relationship. I think different constituencies in Turkey responded to different aspects of our Iraq policy. I think for some, many in Turkey, the mere fact that we were attacking a Muslim country was a source of great offense. Was a source of great anguish, I should say, and they took great offense at it. And actually, although the Turkish government strongly and has continued actively to participate in the Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, the Pew polls over the years showed a considerable amount of opposition in Turkey to our attacking even Afghanistan. So there is a certain segment of the Turkish public opinion that responds to that. Another segment, or maybe all segments, respond to the Kurdish-related dimension, whether it's our failure to rein in the PKK or to allow Turkey to rein in the PKK, or the belief among many that we're actively supporting a separate state in northern Iraq. All of those things have combined, I would say, along with some dramatic incidents like the July 4th incident, which even July 4th, 2003, which I was reminded again on my recent trip, has amazing legs. People still talk about it all the time. All of that combined to reach a point where when you hear we have a 9% approval rating, I personally found it hard to find exactly who those 9% were. But but I trust the Pew people. And I take hope in them. As to your specific question, Mark, about, look, I think what Soner was, well, I don't want to interpret Soner's remarks. AK Party has pursued a balancing act regarding relations with the U.S. Certainly at the senior level, it has tried to work effectively with the United States as much as possible. It has wanted the legitimacy that comes from that, in my view, if for no other reason, because international legitimacy is an important shield for it in what it sees as its ongoing struggle with the Turkish military. And I think it has every reason to be responsive to the U.S., and I think it was in many ways, and Cyprus was the great example of that. And as I said, it's Cyprus diplomacy still wins in many points in Washington, certainly in Congress, but I think also in the executive branch. What it has not, it seems to me, done effectively is stood up and spoken out in a consistent fashion in defense of the relationship. Now, you might say, well, how could it, given all the problems? And maybe there's an argument. Maybe there's an argument to be made like that, and I certainly wouldn't have expected Erdogan in the middle of a political campaign to have made pro-Americanism his theme, given the state of our popularity there. But I do think over the course of the past 5 years, and particularly since things really went south after the Iraq invasion of March 03, I do think that he could have given a few statesmanlike speeches explaining to his public, with which he has great capital, just why, despite all the problems that are deriving from the U.S. presence in Iraq, that relationship with Washington remains important and should be nourished by Turks. I met last year when I was in Turkey, I met with former president and former prime minister Demirel, who also once upon a time won a huge victory in the polls, over 50% back in the 1960s, and as we know was one of the titans of Turkish politics for about 40 years. And I was asking him about anti-Americanism. It was a private conversation. I don't think I'm betraying any confidences, though. He talked about the importance of leaders standing up. He said when he was prime minister during the arms embargo, I think, even though there probably aren't too many people in this audience who remember it. Yeah, I know a few of us do. Thank you. I think I was actually, well, anyway. I was already in mid-career in the State Department when it happened. Anyway, following the 1974 Turkish intervention in Cyprus, the U.S. Congress put an arms embargo on Turkey, 1975 to 78. Let me tell you, there were no polls in those days. I was a student in Turkey for part of that time. I don't think we would have gotten 9% at that time. And the depth of anger was much more intense, at least than I find it now. Demirel pointed out that he met with President Carter in 1977 in the midst of this and gave described to me as a major speech about the importance of U.S.-Turkish friendship. Now, I have not checked him out. I haven't looked up the speech. I'm taking his word at face value. I don't remember the speech, but nor was I following Turkey at that point. I have no reason to disbelieve him. I think that kind of example is something that it would have been nice to have seen the prime minister emulate frequently, at least on a consistent basis. But do I put the primary blame on him for our low poll ratings? No, I do not. It's Iraq. It's all about Iraq.
Thanks, Alan. I have a lot of people waiting for questions. We don't have much time left, so we'll try to do a quick round. So I call out your names. Please wait for the mic to come to you and do identify yourselves. I have Rafi Danziger here.
Yeah, my question is addressed to Matt. And picking up a point that was made by Ellen with regard to the pipeline supposed to go from Iran via Turkey to Europe, whether or not there's an investment in a South Pars oil field, I think it's a very, very important development if it actually comes to fruition that Iran becomes a major source of natural gas to Europe, and there's talk even about Turkmenistan, Iran, and then Turkey. Could you comment on this whole issue, as well as in general about Turkish-Iranian relations? Thank you.
Sure, thank you. As either Soner or Alan said, yeah, we don't really have a clear reading on what exactly this statement of intent entails, other than it is a statement of intent. It appears to talk about the possibility of upstream investment at South Pars. And as you suggest, yeah, that would be of great concern to us. It would be a violation of the Iran Sanctions Act and would be a violation of U.S. policy. Everybody in this room knows what U.S. policy is with regard to Iran, and According to the Iran Sanctions Act, any investment over $20 million in Iran is, I guess we can say, prohibited, although there are real questions about the extraterritorial reach, of course, of any bit of American legislation. But clearly, we would be strongly opposed to any such investment at this particular moment when, in fact, there is a clear international position and international legal decisions as reflected in Security Council resolutions on doing all we can, essentially, to keep the pressure on Iran to give up its nuclear enrichment program. So we hope that this statement of intent never comes to anything, but we don't really know what's in the minds of the people who signed this letter of intent. As you probably know, there are already some international companies that are working at South Pars. Gazprom is there, as is Total. I think Shell is as well. And I'll just leave it at that. In terms of our broad relationship with Iran, our relationship with Turkey on Iran, the cooperation has been quite good, in fact. I mean, Turkey has always said it will abide by and has always abided by the Security Council resolutions. Turkey has made clear it shares our deep opposition to Iran acquiring nuclear weapons and to its enrichment program. 2 years ago, when we were talking about the EU3 position, Turkey all the way through maintained solidarity with that position of the EU. And so in a macro sense, when it comes to nonproliferation in Iran, our relationship is solid with Turkey. In terms of neighborly relations and the historical scope of bilateral relations, well, Turkey clearly has a different view on Iran than we do. I mean, Turkey, with its policy of strategic depth, and the fact, as we often hear from the foreign minister and others, Turkey has had, a stable relationship with Iran since, 1639 or something? He always likes to cite that statistic. Well, Turkey is in a different place in a broad strategic sense with regard to Iran. But the key thing is to maintain our solidarity as reflected in the Security Council resolutions. Beyond that, I just hope that we all hope that this statement of intent on the gas cooperation doesn't go any further. We all do know as well, though, Turkey already does have a gas pipeline with Iran. That does not involve any upstream investment. So as you said, moving into upstream investment at South Pars would be a new phase that would be, require us to take a long, hard look, and the State Department would make its advice to the Department of the Treasury with regard to the Iran Sanctions Act. Thank you.
I have Congressman Swallows next.
Thank you very much. A question for Alan and then also for Matt. For Alan, what are the prospects for the passage of the Armenian resolution in the House? And for Matt,
it took so long.
what do you think would be the actual and practical consequences of the adoption of that resolution for Turkish-American relations, and what is the administration doing to persuade the Congress not to adopt it?
I'm not sure how I would handicap it, Steve, to be honest. I think there are a couple of interesting dimensions here. As we know that the resolution has over 218 co-sponsors. Which means a majority of the House of Representatives. That's psychologically a significant figure, but as you know, it doesn't necessarily mean anything operationally. If you could get 218 signatures on a discharge petition, that would be very significant. That would bring it to the floor, but I don't think there's any reason to assume that those 218 co-sponsors would all sign a discharge petition. I'm quite sure not all of them would. You also have the element where the two leaders of the House, the Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, are both people who have a longtime personal commitment on this issue. So I don't think they look at it as, some kind of annoying issue to be managed, but I think it's something that if they had their way, it would pass. Now, that said, the executive branch has a lot of strong arguments to make, the strategic arguments, particularly because of Turkey's importance regarding Iraq. And I don't think the operations that we stage through Turkey can be Iraq-related operations, could be easily moved or replaced. So I think those are the parameters. It's a tough issue. The executive branch will have to fight it at a very high level. Now, I'll just say, add one other piece that may be of interest. The administration came out of the box on this very quickly in this term, and they were lobbying Congress at very senior levels. And as some of you know, the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense jointly wrote a letter about it. I think it went to a higher level than it, more quickly than it ever had in any past. You remember more of them, sorry to say that I do, but in any past such battle over over this type of resolution. But they made two basic sets of points. One was the obvious strategic point, Turkey's strategic importance and how this could, if Turkey so chooses, endanger U.S. operations in Turkey. And the other point was, this is an election year in Turkey, and we don't want to become a factor in the elections. Now, when I think that point resonated with a lot of people on the Hill. Now, when it first resonated, it was foreseen that there would be presidential elections in April and parliamentary elections in November. What seems to have happened now, and it's, at least as I understand it, it's still not an impossibility that the whole electoral process could drag on for the rest of the year if Parliament fails to elect a president and has to have new elections, and then you have presidential elections after the referendum. I mean, there are many possible scenarios which would take, which would push the date much further, but it appears in reality, most likely, that we're going to finish this election process far earlier than was foreseen at the beginning of the year when lobbying on this issue started. And I think it means that we'll be coming to some sort of crunch point quite soon. Does that answer you? I hope that answers your question.
That was so insightful and comprehensive, Steve. I wonder if you let me get away with saying he commented and said all there is to say. No, probably not. No. I'd like to. But Alan, you described what we've been doing. Thank you. Yeah, we did. We were off the mark quickly and at a very high level. And we're going to continue that approach. And it's important to, I think, understand that this issue has two pieces to it. There is the political, security, practical side of the argument that Alan has articulated so clearly. And then there's the moral, historical side of the argument as well, which is the one that, in many ways, really so deeply matters to the community and to the peoples of Turkey and of Armenia and all over the world, anybody who cares about this issue. Our view is clear on the whole question, and it's articulated every year by the president in his statement every year. So we don't think legislating the resolution of this profound psychological, philosophical, historical, moral debate is a wise way to go. We don't deny that anything happened one way or the other. We simply don't believe it's correct that an issue of such enormous moral and human significance, such as how we refer to these horrible events, be determined through a vote by politicians. The best way forward, it seems to us the most just way and the most sort of philosophically and humanly meaningful way to go forward would be to have a real discussion such as has never happened before among experts across the spectrum. Yes, politicians, but philosophers and common people and historians and moralists, all kinds, sociologists, How you do that, I don't know. I mean, the Armenian side has said so far the proposal on the table for such a commission that Turkey has suggested doesn't go far enough. Okay, well, let's think through then what sort of a dialogue would be appropriate. But there has to be some sort of a dialogue among the peoples who for so long were one, in fact, people in so many ways, despite ethnic differences. I mean, they were also living together in harmony and successfully and prospering together for so long. Alan said something at the end that sounds somewhat ominous, as if things are moving or going to move. So we could use some help from the Turkish government as well. We really need something now in this post-election climate that moves toward a normalization of relations with Armenia. It's time for that to happen. We're beyond, hopefully beyond, much of the fog of electoral politics. We're not all the way they're not all the way out yet. But it is time for some serious steps on both sides to normalize that relationship. It's a very abnormal state of affairs historically. And every time we engage with our friends in Ankara, of course, we make this point. And when I go to Yerevan, as I'm going to do a week from today, of course this will be a top issue on the agenda, how to restore the normalcy of Turkish-Armenian relations, which is one of friendship and almost, you know, deep familiarity of a common family in some ways.
Thanks, Matt. I think, Alan, you have something to add?
Yeah, let me just quick, because I know you asked, what will the Turks do? And I just wanted to... when I was in Turkey 2 weeks ago, an editor of a significant daily newspaper said to me, if it passes, I will feel constrained to write an editorial calling for suspension of operations at Incirlik. I think he was sincere. I heard things like that quite often. Now, of course, anyone who opposes this resolution in Turkey is probably not going to tell me, oh, we won't do anything. Could I have been, was he spinning me? I don't know, but I don't really think so. I think it was a sincere sentiment, and it involves tough choices for Turkey, but I think there will be a lot of public pressure for something like that. By the way, I didn't, Matt, on your,
yeah,
regarding the previous thing I said about post-election, I didn't mean to suggest this is about to happen. Unlike the rumor that was making the rounds and hit the Turkish press last week, I don't see this happening before August recess. I just think, and this is my own speculation and analysis, that getting past the elections is an important psychological threshold for those who want to pass the resolution.
Thank you. I have many hands waiting, and I'd like to get to as many of you as possible before we wrap up. So please, I'm going to ask you to pose brief questions, and my co-panelists try to be concise, so I have you next, sir. And please identify yourself.
Greg Rosen in the Senate. Alan, you had most of all, three of you spoken most about the military and talked about the implication of a selection again of Gul. But I want to ask the question directly about the military, and if whatever, Matt, you can say, great. What is your sense of what the military will do with this election result? How will they deal with potential scenarios that come out in the presidential election and the change in the process of electing a president? And is there a possibility of a military intervention that could be quite dramatic if those results are ones that are very problematic for the military?
I'm glad that question is to you, so.
You're welcome to comment. Look, when I said something about Gul, I said it would be an interesting test case of, I think Erdogan's acceptance speech strongly indicated he's not going to go in that direction. As for the military, it's my belief, I don't know, of course, what's going on in their heads. I don't think that the result changes very much about what their red lines are, particularly on the presidency.
Barbara Slavin next.
I'm not sure that in and of itself. I think that is an important red line. I can't foresee circumstances in which that would be acceptable. But the reason I'm hesitating is because I think sometimes people say it's all about the headscarf, when in fact it's not only the headscarf, but it's putting the presidency, which is the hub of the establishment in many ways and controls so many of the key power positions within the bureaucracy, I think they want to make sure someone they can work with is in that position. So it's the headscarf, yes, but beyond that.
Bob Friedman.
You talked about movement on the PKK issue. Could you go into more detail? Because that seems to be the key for improving relations. And also, Sonar, maybe you would help on this one because you've written about it. If, in fact, we have a relatively moderate policy by the prime minister to court the center right, he still has a constituency of Islamists to satisfy. Do you see him reaching out to them by taking a harsher position toward Israel, inviting Hamas yet again to satisfy that constituency and taking other actions of that sort?
Yeah, and PKK, thank you, Bob. I can't go into much detail, obviously, but I can say that at our highest level of the government, the appointment of General Ralston had an impact on cutting through not just red tape, but I guess part of the mixed metaphor, but opening the doors that were closed in the world in which people plan activities. And so minds are more focused than they've ever been before on the realities, on the dangers posed by the PKK, especially since it's lifted its ceasefire and resumed those attacks in Turkey. We know how impatient everybody is. It's clear from the warnings that we've heard across Turkey's political spectrum. Foreign Minister Gulli even said a couple weeks ago that there need be no further legislative authorization for the military to take steps. We heard it. We're listening. And I hope you will see that we are responding together with Turkey and the government of Iraq. I'm sorry I can't go into further detail.
Thanks, Matt. In response to this question, an issue that we discussed earlier, I agree with my co-panelists that what we have seen in Turkey is an incredible show of democracy, incredible performance. And the beauty of Turkey, you can, regardless of where you look at it, whether you cut from the right or from the left, there is a beauty in this. This is the only predominantly Muslim country that's a liberal democracy, and it's the only democracy that has an Islamist party running and thriving. So regardless of where you look at it, it's a case you can take a look at and say this is something good. But beyond that, I think beyond the domestic, international and domestic repercussions of that, the issue that I was alarmed by or have been alarmed by and been writing on extensively is how, anti-Americanism and for that purpose and anti-Semitism has become pervasive and an open source of discussion and jokery. It's not anymore, stuff pundits write about. It's stuff people joke about. It's that acceptable. And I think, you can look at many factors driving that. Absolutely Iraq war, absolutely PKK, unintended consequences of the Iraq war, all of that. But there's also, there's been a tendency by the government to use foreign policy for a domestic popularity boosting contest. And so, Hamas visit, chances that it would happen before the elections were nil. Chances that it will happen after the elections exist as always. There were rumors a while ago that Turkey was going to invite Hamas again. People said, is this likely? I said probably not before the elections because the government has a fine balance, has to strike a fine balance in terms of both driving popularity from its foreign policy rhetoric inside and as well maintaining good ties with the United States and with the West in diplomatic, behind diplomatic closed doors on the other side. And that balance, I think, will continue over the next few years unless, someone makes a clear statement that's not an acceptable balance because it is really hurting the core of U.S.-Turkish relationship, which is Turkish public attitudes that are favorable towards the United States. That's, I think, what ultimately a relationship stands on. Of course, it is PKK. Of course, it is EU. But you ultimately need to have people who support that kind of relationship. That's being eroded. And I think part of that erosion is people's change of identity, where, for me, the problem is in the post-9/11 world, it's not that, Turkey's an overwhelmingly Muslim country. It's the fact that the Turkish political identification is increasingly with Islam in this post-9/11 world where I don't think, we'd like to see that kind of split. We'd like to see Turkey stay in the West and be Muslim at the same time. I'm going to stop here, and I think we're out of time. I want to thank my co-panelists both together for coming here and a great round of discussion. Thank you.